You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon. You're listening to KYRS. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and today I've got a show for you that's basically a really intense and probably fairly overwhelming, at least for me, sum up of this entire last summer. So if you're a regular listener to the show, you know that I've been on the road since July 5th. Very happy to be recording this now from the production room studio at KYRS back in my radio homeland. And if you're also a listener to my great fellow show, So There I Was, on KYRS as well, every Friday, you know that I've been posting dispatches to their show, because those guys are great, and called Rest Stop Revelations. So what I did by way of telling the whole story of the summer, this long, crazy summer, is I've just stitched all of those together for you. So you're going to hear basically my entire trip condensed down into an hour, 2 months into an hour. So along with some music, and it's really more of a storytelling format than a facts and figures kind of heavy show that you might be used to from me. So it was really amazing. I want to just thank all the people who helped me make this happen this summer. Everybody at KYRS who was patient with my unpredictable schedule and the fact that I was recording from various people's living rooms, sometimes train stations, sometimes parks, wherever I could find some semblance of quiet to record. So you'll hear that there's a little variance in audio quality on all of these, but they're all good stories, and I met so many great people this summer, and I'm excited to share all of that with you. So again, you're listening to Praxis. This is the summary of the Praxis Summer Roadshow. And the whole idea behind it, if you are maybe just listening for the first time or missed out on the summer because you were doing summer things, I kind of set out on this because the mission of Praxis from its inception a little over 3 years ago has been to look at social change theory, social change methodology, mostly by talking with organizers, activists, artists, other people who make social change happen. And I've loved doing that with regional people, with local people. But this summer, a lot of things are coming to a head movement-wise. We're seeing, unfortunately, I mean, I miss the fires here, but we're seeing the effects of climate change faster than a lot of people had predicted. There's a building resistance to the culture and mechanisms that accelerate climate change, including capitalism itself, Black Lives Matter becoming a huge force all over the country, and many other movements. So as you'll hear, I was able to kind of dip a toe into a lot of these different areas, made some great connections. I still have many more interviews that have not been shared yet on the show. But you can find the podcast most easily by either following the link that's at kyrs.org on my show page or going directly to my blog at truthscout.net. They're going to be in the sidebar there. You can subscribe to the RSS feed. So with that, here are the first chunk of Rest Stop Revelations for you. So here I am, 4 days into this long summer, and already feel like I've been gone a long time. The mission of this journey is to interview activists, organizers, and average people from all over about climate change, fossil fuel extraction, and the movements of resistance to that extraction, alternatives to capitalism, models for living and working cooperatively, and the atmosphere of change as it varies from place to place. I'm recording today from Dunsmuir, California, in the shadow of Mount Shasta, a place that boasts about having the best water on Earth. After a few days of intensive interviews and a lot of driving, I'm ready for a couple days of restorative mountain time. The headwaters of the Sacramento River, one of the largest in the West, are nearby. The water there takes years to reach the surface, filtering up through the mountain before it spills out in an unassuming stream that eventually builds into a powerful river. People have been gathering at the headwaters for thousands of years, and the healing and spiritual properties of the water there have been spoken of for most of that time. As I prepare to head into the heart of the serious drought affecting the West, I'll bring a little bit of it with me for luck, or something. I'm not the only one with my eyes on it, though. Crystal Geyser has recently built a facility here to bottle the water, part of a worldwide effort to privatize water sources. I'll be posting more links and information about that issue on my blog for people who are curious about finding out more. I spent the first 2 days of the Praxis Summer Roadshow in familiar territory, mostly in Portland, Oregon. There, and in Eugene, I conducted 5 interviews with activists and organizers working on issues ranging from climate change education to permaculture design, to democratizing workplaces, to supporting political prisoners, to questioning the model of civilization itself. The common tie between these conversations ended up being anarchism, which makes sense, though it wasn't fully intentional. If you listen to Praxis regularly, you've probably picked up that I'm also an anarchist and have attempted to dispel some myths about anarchist ideas over recent years for the local audience. It isn't surprising that many people misunderstand anarchism. Even the dictionary definition focuses on synonyms like chaos and disorder. The true root of the concept, though, is in radical democracy and building a world without hierarchy, ideas that most people support when described in different words. Any truly grassroots organizing that builds consensus among a group of people based on the needs and values of the group is, whether labeled this way or not, anarchistic. There's an ongoing tension between radical visions like these that demand we change not one policy, but everything about the way we relate to each other and the planet, and the liberal tradition of attempting to improve upon mass institutions one piece at a time. One macro focus of this series is this tension between reform and revolt as we accelerate toward ever more dire outcomes of our growth and domination-based models of life. Spending so much time in a car has given me so much to think about, including the car itself. As I burn up fossil fuels, to explore the destructive power of fossil fuels, I wonder about the contradiction that's present in so much of what we do as we try to help make the world a better place. I want to start giving people rides along the way, but for now it's been just me and my thoughts and a whole lot of strange talk radio and guilty pleasure pop music. Individualism, another thing I'm not crazy about along with cars, has been part of the story too. Alone in a car, among other people alone in cars, in their own worlds, lacking a lot of connection to one another and especially to the planet as you zoom by all of the land that changes around you. A person like me could lose their mind thinking about the history of this country, and that's even more true when you're driving along the fateful route of Lewis and Clark, past dams, nuclear waste, and agricultural dust storms. I'm thankful that I brought along a CD collection of Howard Zinn's People's History of the 20th Century to keep me company and remind me that I'm not, in fact, insane for thinking that a lot of this wasn't the best idea. So now we're looking at how we can go forward in a different way that's a little bit healthier for each other and the planet. I'm glad to do this work, and especially to bring the rest of you along for the ride. From here, I'll be heading into the Central Valley and then east into the desert to see parts of the country I've never seen, and for the first time, fracking up close and personal. So, here I am in Salt Lake City, Utah, having just returned from a walk around the grounds of Global Mormon Headquarters at Temple Square. My host told me that this city is mostly divided into 2 groups, those who are very Mormon and those who are very adamant about their lack of religion and show it in every way possible. What most struck me about Salt Lake that I hadn't expected to see is the huge oil refinery, the Holly Refinery, right next to the freeway, that competes with the skyline just a moment away from downtown. At night, it's lit up like a dystopian city Terry Gilliam might imagine, both a departure from and a complement to the imposing architecture of the Capitol Dome, the towers of the temple, and the towering church office skyscraper. I spent most of the last 2 days driving. Driving north on I-15 from Las Vegas to Salt Lake made me think that if I lived here, I might turn into a fire and brimstone radio preacher too. It's a stark country of rocks and dramatic angles that seems to stretch on forever in a hot, dry monotony, broken by occasional breathtaking sights. The West is big, to be sure,
And Las Vegas, in some respects the most quintessentially American city in the United States, is big too. I had planned to take in the sights there and photograph the strip, but after driving for 6 hours and struggling to juggle too many interviews at once, my enthusiasm had waned a bit. I can, however, assure listeners that despite dwindling supplies of fossil fuels and water, Vegas is still very much happening. At nightfall, when I arrived, the strip screamed toward the freeway, an onslaught of light and spectacle so loud it's rendered meaningless. It's a place built intentionally outside of reality, with imitations of other places that don't attempt to hide the fact that they're imitations. It's a place to escape, that worships escapism, even. And as listeners know, escapism is not really my game. So as I escaped to drive north to Mesquite, where I'd sleep that night, I was relieved to see those yelling lights recede in my rearview mirror until they were just a quiet bed of coals in the distance. I drove into the desert, alone on the road, into a darkness so comforting in its emptiness by comparison. And on the theme of big things, the Central Valley in California qualifies as well. I knew, already, going in, as most people do, that it's the region responsible for a huge proportion of our nation's food production. I had traveled through to talk to people about the ongoing drought there, and see how it's affecting agriculture, and you can hear more about that in interviews and writings that are being published now. What I didn't know was just how huge it would look in person. Miles upon unfathomable miles of corn, almonds, grapes, corn, tomatoes, apricots, corn, cotton, corn again, unfurling like a green and alternately brown blanket. Plumes of dust blow around the road as the drought continues, and yard signs declare that for homeowners, brown is the new green. It seems that nearly every system in this country has been built on the assumption that we can depend on oil, the most powerful energy source humans have ever known, indefinitely. As the planet warms from the pollution caused by its extraction, especially in extreme forms like fracking, and as the supplies dwindle, we'll be forced to grapple with this infrastructure problem. Most aspects of industrial-scale life, from agriculture to the highway system that I'm using so heavily this summer, to trade, will be forced into question. Even now, communities all over are pushing back against large-scale pollution in their communities. I started this past week in Richmond, California, at a rally against oil trains and other forms of extreme fossil fuel extraction and transport across the state. Speakers at the rally tied in the issues of pollution to public health, to racial justice, to capitalism itself, to immigration rights, and to faith. By becoming intersectional in this way, I think that the movement to address climate change has the potential to win both hearts and minds, but also to win strategic victories for planetary health, both through advocacy and direct action. I was able to interview a few of these activists in the Bay Area and also in Fresno, and I'm now busy editing those and posting them online between long stretches on the road. Next, I'll be heading into some of the rural areas of Utah, where fracking is shaping policy and health for people who live there, and then into Colorado before heading north again for the final stretch of the first month of the Praxis Summer Roadshow. So here I am in Denver, Colorado, about to say goodbye to some amazing people who have made this a great temporary home the last few days. When I arrived here, my host Deborah had organized a backyard bonfire with everyone she could think of who I might like to meet. She's one of the crucial types of people I would call connectors in a community. They seem to know everyone, understand how people and issues are linked, and have the communication skills to bring it all together. I came through from Fort Collins, Colorado, where I spent a restorative couple of days catching up on the behind-the-scenes work that's involved in this kind of trip with my new friend Karen. Before that, I spent an intense day looking at fracking, mining, and more in and around Vernal, Utah. I interviewed Donna Young, the midwife who's lately made headlines for her attempts to find out what's killing babies and making mothers sick in her town. It was intense, and I definitely needed the rest and processing time before I headed to Denver for a dense few days of meeting people. You can hear that interview with Donna in part on this week's Praxis show. In Denver, I met some great people and got to reconnect with an ex-Spokaneite friend who's worked in radio, both at KYRS and around the country. I made plans for the next day to hike at Red Rocks, an incredible venue and museum and park, and then to attend the rehearsal of a great, impressive, my new favorite arts group on earth called the Romero Theater Troupe. The Romero Troupe tells the hidden stories of history through theater, and I was able to watch them practice bringing characters from Colorado state history
War resistors, striking workers, women taking leadership, early transgender activists, and more in a collaborative way. There's no director. It's all participatory. It's chaos, and it's awesome. In the Denver-Boulder area, I also met Arturo Hernandez-Garcia on his last day of 9 months living in the basement of the Unitarian Church in Denver. He's living there in sanctuary while facing deportation. We talked about immigration, unfair treatment of immigrants and undocumented people in the U.S., and what's next for him as he's finally allowed to go home without such a high degree of fear. I drove to Boulder from there and reconnected with David Barsamian, who KYRS listeners know from his weekly broadcast, Alternative Radio, on Monday mornings at 9 a.m. We talked about independent media, the importance of telling important stories, and so much more. He gave me a gift of his latest talk with Vandana Shiva on radical compassion for the more bleak parts of my drive. His work interviewing the renegades of our times has been a huge inspiration to me, and I was so glad to reconnect with him. And also in Boulder, on this long day, I met Michelle Gabrieloff Parrish, who's working to educate people in her area about the toxic nuclear legacy of Rocky Flats. You can hear a portion of that interview on this week's Praxis show tomorrow at 4 p.m. I finished last night's long day by talking with Jamie Laurie and Stefan Brackett, better known as Johnny Five and Br'er Rabbit of the Flowbots fame, about their new project No Enemies, which aims to bring song back into social movements and encourages us to connect on a human level that's both participatory and invitational. I loved talking with these guys about hacking pop culture, bringing back old ways that worked for us better, and even getting to sing a little with them. From here, I'll be heading into South Dakota and then back west and north to look more at extreme oil, indigenous-led resistance to extreme oil, and more.
I am a sleeping giant. There lives a riot in my bones. I am a sleeping giant. There lives a riot in my bones. I am a sleeping giant. There lives a riot in my bones. I am a sleeping giant. There lives a riot in my bones. That's one example.
That was easy.
It's easy, right? Yeah.
So here I am, back in Spokane for the blink of an eye to drop off the borrowed car I've been using for the last month that has brought me safely across thousands of miles and begin the second half, the mass transit half, of the summer roadshow in Detroit, Michigan. It's been a wild week leading up to this relaxing moment at home. It started in Rapid City, South Dakota, where I'd been referred to contacts in rural organizing and Lakota activists working to stop the Keystone XL pipeline from coming through their supposedly treaty-protected land. When I showed up, a project was already underway, the construction of a 20-foot-long black snake symbolizing the pipeline that would be worn and carried by activists at a demonstration at the Capitol in Pierre, South Dakota. Black plastic, hula hoops, and small boards quickly transformed into an impressive, wearable, and portable piece of activist art. After the project was complete, I was invited to dinner at the home of Dale, South Dakota's artist laureate, and his wife, Jane, with a group of friendly and passionate rural and tribal organizers. We talked about the deep segregation and racism that pervades the area and the ways that alliances are being built over a shared desire between indigenous people there and others who depend on the land, like ranchers and farmers. I slept that night on their property in a teepee that allowed a view of the stars and a very active cloud of bats. In the morning, I interviewed Chaz about her work on racism and sustainability, and she pointed me in the direction of the Rosebud Spirit Camp, located on tribal land a few hours away. After getting significantly lost, because who puts I-83 right next to I-183, I made it to the camp where I met Leota and by phone, Gary, two of the leaders of the camp. It's in a beautiful open area and consists of a sweat lodge, a trailer, some windbreak infrastructure, and three teepees. For now, the site is used for spiritual purposes, but it sits in the path of the Keystone XL pipeline. If construction begins on that pipeline, the Rosebud Sioux are prepared to defend their land at the site. It was incredibly beautiful there, and I enjoyed my short time and tour. I was also told about a similar camp in Alberta that I planned to visit to complete the circle and observe the connections that tie people together through water and through shared potential devastation from a pipeline and other oil infrastructure.
From South Dakota, the place I've been most pleasantly surprised by so far, I drove straight through Wyoming and to the east entrance of Yellowstone National Park, where my friend Rachel works and the network of service stations run there. It was my first time in Yellowstone. It's an eerie and strange place, a mixture of rugged and deadly natural beauty and the traditional trappings of industrial civilization, like, say, service stations. The two converge in dangerous ways. A few days before I came to the park, a woman was gored by a bison, the fifth this year, when she attempted to take a selfie with it. I was in the worst traffic jam I've been in since the San Francisco Bay, also caused by bison colliding with photography. I was glad to see the park, though briefly, as it is changing so quickly. Places like Yellowstone, a geological anomaly in our country, are bellwethers for climate change, and it will not look this way in 5 years. I headed north out of the park and took a dip in the boiling river on the way out. I crossed into Canada without incident and drove another huge stretch to Calgary, Alberta. I planned to explore a little bit that evening and in the morning before heading north and west to the Unist'ot'en camp that I mentioned before. I had a vague notion of where it's located and the whole day ahead of me. As I headed north to Edmonton, though, I was stopped short on the freeway by the worst storm I've ever seen. Rain so dense that it obscured visibility and within moments left standing water on the freeway. Cars slid, mine included, and I watched multiple semi-trucks slide sideways and off of the freeway. The wind picked up and blew cars back and forth. I'm not sure how we all made it, but I'm glad to have been surrounded by responsible and careful drivers. I scanned through the radio and heard not only a severe thunderstorm warning for my area, but a tornado warning for the western part of the province. I looked to my left, to the west, and the sky was turning green. I decided that perhaps this was not the day to pursue this specific goal, as I'd rather live to see the rest of my trip, and my life for that matter. I turned back and realized I could make it through to Osuyas, the border town just across from my extended family in Orville, Washington, that night instead of the following day if I pushed through. Deep in the Canadian Rockies of southern British Columbia, though, I encountered the second worst storm I've ever seen. Rain, wind, followed by mist too thick to see through, followed me through the mountain passes. I nearly hit a caribou, the size of my car, and then nearly hit a dog. I hadn't seen another car in either direction for 40 minutes and started to feel like I was in an episode of The X-Files. After having enough near-death experiences in those 12 short hours, I decided to just stop and sleep in Castlegar, BC. I drove down the next day to the comfort of my grandma's house, saw my family, and then got to see my beloved, dirty, brick and river city appear over the lip of the freeway. From here, I'll fly to Detroit and then travel the East Coast in search of climate stories, tales of alternative ways of being, and more.
If you're just joining us on the show, you're listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and I've been playing the Rest Stop Revelations segments that I recorded this summer for So There I Was, another fellow KYRS show. And I've been, as you've heard, all over the place. That last stretch before coming back to Spokane was very intense. And I'll play for you, as by way of segue, one of the songs that kind of got me through that incredibly harrowing drive that I went on. But yeah, if you're just joining us, that's what you're listening to. The show is Praxis. This is kind of a big summary of a big summer roadshow for me and for Praxis. I have way more interviews that I'm going to be slowly unraveling throughout the fall and winter when I don't have a live guest. So many contacts for good shows in the future. If you're curious about any of these people I've mentioned in these segments, if you want to hear the full interviews, you can either check my blog, truthscout.net, or you can send me an email for any feedback of any kind at praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, at kyrs.org. And this is a great time to give a shout out to my fellow radio awesome person, Gavin Dahl, used to be the news director here at KYRS. I met his wife, Katie, for the first time. So Gavin and Katie Dahl gave me the only CD of music somehow that I had on this trip. Thankfully, it was great. It was Elephant Revival. And that's who you'll hear from now as we segue into the second half of these segments from this long trip. So thanks, Gavin and Katie, for providing me with my only music. And this is The Break in the Clouds by Elephant Revival.
Oh, the clouds, oh, the clouds, see the break in the clouds. Feel the sun shining down through the clouds. Oh, the clouds, oh, the clouds, see the break in the clouds. Feel the sun shining down through the clouds.
So here I am in Detroit, Michigan, where I've been posted up for the last 6 days with a good friend from Spokane who's been celebrating her birthday here and some new-to-me friends who we've been staying with. We've done a lot of urban exploration with the benefit of some guest bikes pulled from the basement, my personal favorite way to explore a new place. The street-level observation you can make from foot or a bike is human-scale, personal, and allows for eye contact, conversation, sensory observation of where you are. After a month of traveling by car, it's incredibly refreshing to get out and move and still have the relative flexibility of a vehicle to rely on. We flew here after a brief but very restorative stay in Spokane and spent our first few days exploring the city and taking photos of art, which is absolutely everywhere. In some ways, the city of Detroit reminds me of Spokane, but more dramatic in every way. The crumbling brick, old trees lining the neighborhoods, and general post-industrial feel are very similar, but it's clear that there's a higher concentration of art here. I'm hopeful that we're moving more in this direction at home, murals everywhere, street art integrated into the environment instead of fought off like a plague, and collaboration between different genres and mediums. This scene was best showcased during our time here by the Sidewalk Festival of Performing Arts, in its second year in the Old Redford and Brightmoor neighborhoods. It's an incredible mix of experimental dance, theater, performance, and installation art alongside music. I got to see Jessica Care Moore perform poetry alongside Ursula Rucker and Wendell Patrick. Their piece, I Can't Breathe, about police violence in the U.S. was, for lack of a better term, breathtaking, and had the audience in complete silence as Patrick breathed into the mic and provided drum tracks, while Jessica's verses were joined by Ursula singing behind. The audio from that performance will appear on this week's Praxis show. A second highlight was seeing Brene Ali, a tap dancer and vocalist who performed a piece she choreographed with three other female dancers that put a space-age twist on tap dance. The street was closed and filled with couches, participatory art projects, kids blowing bubbles and playing ping pong, and a mix of people from around the city. We topped it off with beers and barbecue for a truly perfect evening. I was also able to visit the farm where my host Corey works, part of a network of farms run by 20-year-old nonprofit The Greening of Detroit in its full summer glory. We planted some parsnips, ate an incredible salad pulled from the harvest, and toured around the 5 greenhouses on site, picking produce for dinner, one of the perks of working on a farm. She introduced me to Anthony, who works in urban gardening and protein farming through a fishery and an abandoned liquor store for CDC, Central Detroit Christian, a multifaceted organization that organizes from the grassroots to meet community need. Anthony then introduced me to Ted, who has worked in farm-to-school programs with Detroit Public Schools and is now working on other permaculture projects around the city. I interviewed them both for the show that will air this Saturday. Continuing a tradition of meeting up with former Praxis guests from further afield, I met Peter Werby, the editor of Fifth Estate and a lifelong Detroiter, and interviewed him about the magazine, which turns 50 this year and is widely recognized as the oldest anarchist publication in the U.S. and likely the world. He's been with the magazine for 49 of those 50 years, and we were able to talk about how acceptance of those ideas has changed over the years and the potential of the strange moment we're now living in. He shared that he thinks it's 1964 in the U.S. again, the inhale before the explosion, and that all of the seeds of serious change have already begun to sprout. I know I've been seeing them in my travels so far, and I'm excited to see what the rest of the east side of the country brings. I'm heading now to Toronto, then Montreal, hoping for better success than in my first attempt at Canadian shows, interrupted by nature's wrath, as you heard last week. I have a feeling this won't be my last time in Detroit, but for now, I'm moving on down the road. So here I am in New York City, having caught an overnight ride from the Bread and Puppet Theater in rural Vermont. I've been a fan of Bread and Puppet's work since I was first introduced to it. They've been performing life-affirming political theater using giant puppets, music, and circus-like presentation for decades and creating a space to express grief over the destruction of empire, joy over the beauty of nature and human connection, and a vision for different ways of being in the world. I managed to find a ride on Craigslist since no bus or public transit travels this way, and spent an enjoyable car ride talking with Danny, a former pastor and also a former radio host, who has sold his stuff and is shuttling people in need around before he heads to Florida. So many people like him have helped me out on this trip, and I love seeing the ways that forums like Craigslist and Couchsurfing can facilitate us helping one another, even as strangers. At Bread and Puppet, I was able to interview Elka Schumann, one of the founding family of the theater, who today curates the extensive Bread and Puppet Museum, operates its printing press, and serves many other roles in the company. I also talked with Joe, one of the current permanent company of puppeteers working there, about his work, rooted in Occupy Wall Street, and how we can use art to express our values and seek a better world. I also talked with Teresa, a woman who moved from Chihuahua, Mexico to join Bread and Puppet and then spent years teaching theater workshops with indigenous youth there until she was interrupted by the drug war's incursion into the community where she had spent so much time. Since then, she's made a documentary film about native corn and farmers in Mexico and returns to Bread and Puppet yearly to take part in the summer performances. You can hear partial interviews with all of them on this week's Praxis show. Before heading to Bread and Puppet, I had been in Montreal, Quebec, where I stayed with and interviewed Sandy, who co-founded the Montreal International Anarchist Theatre Festival and works with the anarchist bookstore Librairie L'Insoumis. We discussed the history of integrating theatre and the arts into activist spaces, and our conversation led me to already plan a second trip to Montreal for the coming May, where they host an entire festival of anarchism. I walked down to Librairie L'Insoumis to pick up a book Sandy had recommended and to interview Kevin, who was working there that day. We talked about the day-to-day of working in the shop and the conversations about anti-authoritarian topics that he inevitably has with strangers, as well as his involvement with the extensive and militant student movement here in Montreal in 2012. I also interviewed Farrell Sage, an anarchist writer who edits stories for Anarchist Writer's Block about how good storytelling can help create a space for resistance and the building of a different sort of society altogether. You can hear pieces of these interviews as well on this week's episode of Praxis. Before Montreal, I was in Toronto for 2 days, where I connected with Toronto War Resisters Support Campaign, a group that has helped American enlisted military personnel seek asylum in Canada since 2004, when they began providing support for those opposed to the invasion of Iraq and ongoing occupations in the Middle East. currently rescheduling that interview by phone, so stay tuned. I also talked by phone in Toronto with Alex, who's working with the Grassy Narrows Youth Organization and the Grassroots Indigenous Water Defense and the Anishinaabe Water Walk from the other end of Ontario as a settler ally on pressing issues faced by frontline Indigenous communities here related to water pollution by the tar sands and fossil fuel and mining industries more generally. I'm also following up with other activists involved in those projects, so check back to my blog for more information as it emerges. Overall, it's been a great journey so far as I continue into the East Coast portion of the roadshow, and I'm looking forward to what New York City has to offer. So here I am in Baltimore, where I just arrived after spending the better part of 3 days in Philadelphia. I came down from New York City, where I stayed with a friend, Mark, I went through all of K-12 school with back in Spokane, who's now living in Brooklyn as a writer. We both spent a great deal of time working, taking a few minutes here and there to trade stories about our stories, and find some levity between researching chemical explosions, for him, and the stacked disasters of climate change, for me. It was my first time in the city, though I'd been pretty well exposed to the mythology of New York City and our culture. I walked a lot there, in keeping with that mythology, to the detriment of my one pair of shoes, but I think they'll hold out for another couple of weeks. If you listened last week, you know that I met a New Yorker who kindly offered me a ride to the city from Bread and Puppet Theater as an epic rainstorm broke out there. I was able to interview her, Janelle, about her work as a cultural strategist, and you can hear a portion of that interview on this week's Praxis show. She introduced me to Rachel, who I was also able to interview while in New York, who works with People's Climate Arts, a collective that grew out of building art and designing the aesthetic experience of the People's Climate March this past year. She also created visuals for Occupy Wall Street and is thinking strategically about the role of artists in the broader movement for social change. The theme of New York City ended up being very centered on women in the arts and, surprisingly, yielded some creative exposure for me as well as a female writer. I had been told by an artist friend in Spokane to contact Heidi, who runs the International Women's Art Salon, a group of over 3,000 women artists from around the world, and hosts a weekly radio show on City World Radio. When I contacted her for an interview, she flipped the script on me and invited me to her show, Salon Radio, to share work and talked about my project and how it fits into the arts world. I met other incredible women there on the cusp of opening an original one-woman theater show and shared an essay and, terrifyingly, a poem with them on the air. It was so great to be supported by other women more experienced in the art world and especially in the world of New York, which I'd assumed would be ripe with competition and cutthroat attitudes. That may be true elsewhere, but it wasn't here, and I was invited to also read work at their monthly in-person salon event. I also spent time seeing art. For as long as I've known about it, I've wanted to see Judy Chicago's landmark piece, The Dinner Party. Produced in the late 1970s, it's a visual representation of women's history around the world and through time, from the primordial goddesses, through ancient Greece and Egypt, to the likes of Sojourner Truth and Virginia Woolf. The research done for the piece is also on display, and it's inspiring to see it listed as something more than the footnote that women are too frequently presented as in what's otherwise a story about men and their accomplishments. Particularly impactful was a companion piece at the Brooklyn Museum created by women incarcerated in New York Women's Prison, in which they recreated the table settings that Judy Chicago had made, but in honor of women important to them, from Biblical Eve to NASCAR driver Danica Patrick, with the materials available in the prison. Painted paper plates, plastic spoons, and repurposed sweaters crocheted into placemats as a reminder of our shared experience that resonates even from behind bars. I loved the rest of the Brooklyn Museum as well, and spent the better part of a day wandering through the exhibits.
I also had a chance to head to the Museum of Modern Art, where Yoko Ono, who I have had a lifelong affinity for, has a solo retrospective show on display. I went through her show, reading all of her tiny instructionals for paintings that wound around the room, and then hit the other modern galleries just in time to take photos of people taking photos on their phones of Van Gogh and Picasso. I also went to Zuccotti Park, returned now to its state as a public plaza, but at least for me, still not absent of the powerful images and ideas that Occupy Wall Street birthed there almost 5 years ago. I visited family and old friends in New York before heading south to Philadelphia. I found an excellent couch-surfing host, Sam, and his cat, Mr. Charles. Sam was on the cusp of opening his new restaurant, a traditional British pie and mash shop called Stargazy, and I was able to help move some things and take some photos in appreciation of his great hospitality during such a busy week. I connected with some incredible people in Philadelphia after showing up, as I had been advised to do, at the Friends Center, where the Quakers have their headquarters and share space with many different advocacy and activist groups and causes. I talked there with Jane, who works with the Quakers, but is currently helping to tie together the struggle for Palestinian freedom from occupation with Black Lives Matter and the struggle for full and equal treatment here in the U.S. from a post-colonial perspective. I went to a town hall meeting of the Coalition for Real, Racial, Economic, and Legal Justice and learned a huge amount about the movement to end police brutality and structural racism in Philadelphia and the broader region. I met and interviewed Anthony, a former professor at Temple University in the African American Studies department, who was laid off alongside other faculty, deeply damaging and shrinking the program there at the same time that the neighborhood around the school gentrifies and the student body becomes more white. I also talked with Asa Khalif, founder of Racial Unity USA and cousin of Brandon Tate Brown, who was killed in December by police in Philadelphia after a routine traffic stop. We discussed his work and recent direct actions against the DA's office and how all people can work together regardless of racial or other social dynamics in their communities for justice. There was even more there in Philadelphia, and I made some great connections for my next stops in Baltimore and Washington, D.C., but we're out of time for this week. So here I am, traveling to Lexington, Kentucky, the last official stop on the Praxis Summer Roadshow, sitting on an Amtrak train from Washington, D.C. to Chicago, the most efficient route to get to Kentucky by rail. I spent just under 24 hours in Washington, D.C., a place I had originally planned to skip past, where I had only been before on a school trip in the 8th grade. I found a kind host on couchsurfing who showed me a Peruvian restaurant in a nearby gas station that I almost certainly would not have found on my own, and we talked politics while watching John Oliver and responding to emails together at his apartment. During the day, I decided that rather than attempt to interview anyone significant in the broad scale, I'd wander around the monuments of the National Mall asking random tourists about America and taking their photos. I had a relative degree of success in doing this, and those short interviews will soon be posted at truthscout.net. I wanted to skip past D.C. as a small but personally significant snub to political culture that's so far removed from much of the work that's being done on the ground in communities that I've spent time in all summer. Communities who often accomplish their goals in spite of or in direct opposition to federal policy. I'm glad that I visited the way that I did, though, and that I captured a small slice of the differences and contradictions that make this country what it is, for better or worse. Before visiting the other Washington, West Coast forever, I spent 4 days in Baltimore, Maryland, which was among my favorite places I'd been so far during this long summer. The pace is in stark contrast to New York and even Philadelphia, and it exists in a strange limbo between North and South in history and in current culture. I stayed with a great group of artists, who are friends of friends, who hosted me well and introduced me to some of the people involved in the vast array of community projects happening in the city. The first day, I went to The Compound, a collectively run housing, art, and farming complex that also houses the Alternative Press Index Library, a growing school called Oak Hill, both of which are featured in a Praxis interview with Nick Petter this week, a wood shop, and a nearly complete recording studio. That night, I also visited a Baltimore institution, Red Emma's, a worker-owned coffee shop and bookstore named for Emma Goldman, to see a panel on race and agriculture,
by an author who toured for 4 months around the U.S. interviewing farmers of color to put a different face on urban farming that would reflect her role in growing food. At the compound, I had also met Tanya Garcia, a resident artist there whose curated show Después de la Frontera, or After the Border, had just opened at Creative Alliance, a collective art space in Baltimore, which featured 7 artists' work on the topic of immigration, primarily by unaccompanied youth, through the U.S.-Mexico border. I was able to interview her about the show, and that talk will be featured on this week's Praxis show as well. I spent a lot of my time there walking around and meeting random people, many of whom wanted to talk about this year's Baltimore uprising. Many people were interested in conveying the parts of the story that were left out by the media's coverage that mostly focused on looting and smashing, rather than the motivation behind those acts and the context that they occurred in. I came out of there with a lot of great resources and an understanding that I hope to also share on this week's show. Before leaving, I made it to the Baltimore Free Farm and talked with Izzy, who's part of the collective that runs the gardens that are part of it, the food distribution hub that redistributes food that would otherwise be wasted, and a second collective, Horizontal Housing, that seeks to develop vacant property in a low-impact way without gentrifying the surrounding area. Once again, all of these topics blend together. Farming and poverty across imaginary lines, generating militarized violence within communities drawn along racial and class lines, people resisting what they've been given when it frankly isn't enough or isn't fair, and artists helping to tell the stories in a way that broadens understanding and compassion. For now, a lot of time to consider all these questions as I take the long train journey west to Kentucky. The train can either be soothing or stressful, depending almost entirely on the company, but it's one of my favorite ways to travel. Even though the U.S. rail system leaves a lot to be desired compared to other countries, there's some degree of romance to the rails that always puts me in a riderly state of mind. I'm looking forward to the opportunity to catch up on my vlog and rest as I head into the real final stretch of a long and intense summer.
All right, wrapping up the hour here with you. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. I'm your host, Taylor, and we've been listening back to kind of all of the segments that I recorded this summer for So There I Was, called Rest Stop Revelations. They're all kind of threaded together into one story, so you can hear a little bit about the great people I was able to meet, the inspiring projects I was able to see, and all of the various trials and tribulations of traveling around this summer for the Praxis Summer Roadshow. You may notice that there's not a final segment yet, and I'm going to record that live for you now. The rest of those, it was kind of a new adventure for me to write pieces in advance. I'm primarily a writer, really, but usually on the show, it's a little more chaotic. It's off the cuff. I'm just kind of winging it a lot of the time, and it was really interesting to actually write something, record it, read, and see. I think it turns out better written in advance, so maybe I'll get my act together and start doing that more on the show. But this last one, this last tiny portion of the show, is just going to be recorded right now at this moment. So and in the keeping with recording it first, So There I Was, I started them all in the following manner. So here I am in the production room studio at KYRS, looking at the familiar sights of the beautifully categorized music library, recording this final segment as I've finally returned home for good, or at least for a while, to Spokane. And I barely missed the incredible and horrible apocalyptic-looking fire and smoke, but I saw it on social media, and in some ways I'm really glad I wasn't here for that because it sounds truly awful. But in other ways, I kind of wish I had been here to see it, especially as I was traveling to cover climate change and look at climate change. And here it was right at home. So I spent the last 2 stops of my trip largely relaxing, largely catching up on writing. First in Lexington, Kentucky, the end of that last segment left off with me on the long train ride, which are always fascinating, meeting a lot of weird characters and kind people on the train and the buses to get to Lexington, Kentucky, where I met Greg and I met the rest of the Central Committee of the Kentucky Workers League. It was great to walk into their office and see a framed copy of The Stranger, all the way in Kentucky, featuring Shama Sawant. They are a Kentucky Workers League is a pretty radical and awesome socialist group made of young people, led largely by women in the Appalachian region, that helps various non-unioned, non-organized workers with different problems. So I met them, spent some great time with them. They have done really awesome direct action in stopping gentrification, supporting specific workers in disputes with their employers, and much more. So I hung out with them in Lexington, interviewed them, learned a lot about that region, caught up on writing, and headed to Bloomington before I knew it, Bloomington, Indiana, where I really didn't plan to do any interviews. I planned to kind of use it as a blank space, a negative space in the trip, staying with an old friend of mine, Mitch, and his roommates who, you know, are musicians, people I've known from the past, and just kind of taking some time to breathe and write and catch up on my blog. And what I really reflected on is how the things I didn't expect about this trip, which were that it would be physically exhausting to travel so much and that it would also be a ton of work. I ended up purging one aspect of the work entirely, which was a street photography project that I had planned, because just doing a blog of the places I was visiting and the photos I was taking of that work, combined with recording an hour-long show every week and a five-minute spot for So There I Was, all of which you just heard, it ended up being more than I bargained for. So I really enjoyed the time resting and hanging out. And then I flew back home. I flew back home yesterday. I'm recording this on Thursday. So I flew home on Wednesday night, met my mom and my sister, and had a really great grilled cheese sandwich at the Satellite, because that's all I had been thinking about for some time. So I'm happy to be home and happy to share the rest of these with you as we move from summer into fall. Thanks for listening. Thanks to everyone who supported this trip, either financially or through moral support. Many people got phone calls when I was agonizing over one aspect or another of it. So thanks, everyone. Thanks, everyone at KYRS for helping make this happen. And thank you for listening. You've been listening to Praxis on KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. I'm going to outro with a little more Elephant Revival. This one's called The Obvious.
Not shaking, sharp, been shaping dark. And the dawn's rays, the dim breaking truth, a blazing, perfect.